Today, of course, is Sri Krishna Janmashtami. The word Ashtami is a feminine word in Sanskrit, Ashtami, which means the eighth, and it refers to the eighth lunar day, Tithi, which is a feminine word. So it's the Krishna's birth on the eighth lunar day. The first thing that occurred to me in meditating on Janmashtami is how kind Krishna is that he appears at all. The very fact that Krishna comes at all, he can do his business in another way. If you think about it, there are actually two opposite states. One is freedom and the other is necessity. So when something must happen, it doesn't happen freely. And when something happens freely, it happens not out of necessity. Now, so you could, if you consider the energy of Krishna, from dead matter all the way up to God, it's actually a scale of freedom and necessity. It's the nature of physical things, any ordinary physical thing, piece of wood or rock or anything, that it acts, it behaves absolutely according to necessity. In other words, we won't go into one of the greatest con debates about our souls and rocks, but take something which clearly is dead, something which is was traditionally very popular in ISKCON, styrofoam cups. So that was before the greening of ISKCON. So if you take something like a styrofoam cup, it has no consciousness to the best of our knowledge. It's not one of the 8,400,000 species of life. It has no consciousness, it has no will, and therefore wherever it goes in its journey through life, that styrofoam cup is going there because of forces acting upon it. If, you know, someone throws it out on the side of the road, which is apparently a popular thing to do in some parts of America, if you throw the styrofoam cup on the side of the road, the wind blows it, or the rain comes, or it gets dug up by some big track that's grading the road, things just happen to it. It doesn't do anything. It has no freedom. It absolutely, everything that happens to it, wherever it goes, it's all by the necessity of material laws. And then if you look at, let's say, going from dead matter up to the lower species of life, E. coli or whatever, you know, the most simple species, they also have very little will. There's very little will about them. Mostly they're simply responding to natural forces outside of them and natural forces within them. Because the material body, any material body, is a mechanism. And that mechanism is acting upon us. Just like, for example, our bodies get hungry at a certain... Well, that's not a good example today. No. Don't want to increase your suffering, but... Let's say, for example, at a certain time of day or night, you get tired. It's something that happens to your body. Just the way your body is made, the way it's constructed as a machine, yantra, Krishna says in the Gita, your body gets tired. It happens to you and affects you. So, to be a conditioned soul, is to be conditioned by the mechanism of the body, which is constructed according to our karma. And so, the more we are conditioned, the less freedom we have. The more we are creatures of necessity. We do things because we must do them, because we simply can't control ourselves. So in that regard, the sinful activities are sinful not because it's the nature of God that He wants to make sure that nobody down here really has a good time. That's not why certain activities are forbidden and are considered sinful. Certain activities are considered sinful because they destroy freedom. They destroy freedom. And so even though we may freely choose, in a sense, to the extent that one that an ignorant person can act freely. Let's say, for example, someone chooses to take an addictive drug or chooses to engage in sexual activity to the extent that it becomes, it goes beyond a choice, it becomes a habit, goes beyond habit, and becomes a type of need and addiction, or drugs, sex, gambling, obviously, all the things for which there are 12-step programs. These activities are considered sinful because we choose them, but they destroy the very freedom that allowed us to choose them. It's like that joke about the guy jumps off this high building and then changes his mind. As he passes each floor on the way down, he says, "Well, so far so good." So to be conditioned means not to be a free, conscious being. And the whole point of bhakti yoga is to bring us to freedom. And Krishna is absolutely free. Krishna is absolutely free for two reasons. One reason is political. There's a very, I'm using the word political not in the sense of, incense smoke-filled rooms in India or, anyway. Political not in the sense of dirty politics and scheming for power. I'm using political in a larger sense, just something involving the acquiring or the exercising of power, the force, and authority over other things or other people. So there is a key political term in the first verse of the Bhagavatam, which is the word swarat. Swarat is one's own, as in mikasa, sukasa. The su in sukasa is just Sanskrit sua. So swa. And rat means governance, power, as in raja. Raja the king, or rajya, the kingdom, and so on. So the first verse of the Bhagavatam is this political term, swarat, self-governing. So Krishna is absolutely free in the sense that he's self-governing. And he's also absolutely free, well, actually the second aspect is in a sense part of the first. Because Krishna is absolutely pure, Krishna, to be perfectly self-governing means not simply that someone external to you is not able to impose their power or authority over you. It also means that you don't become subjugated to your own lust or greed. In other words, there are powers within us. There are powers in the universe, powers within us that can overcome us and rob us of our freedom. There is a potential for lust within our own body if we activate it. And once activating it, if we cultivate it, it actually takes over and we lose our freedom. We become enslaved by that power that we unleashed upon ourselves. So Krishna is Swaraj, he's self-governing, in the sense that there is no power anywhere. Of course, Maya is his own power. And the Bhagavatam stresses this. Because sometimes, to quote the cliche, somebody creates a monster. Isn't it? I mean, that's a common saying, like, oh my God, he created a monster. In the sense that, Dr. Frankenstein, that's where it comes from, right? Created a monster. Shelley's wife wrote that. Anyway, so, Mrs. Shelley wrote that book. So, the idea is, we can originally create something or unleash something or authorize something that then becomes a monster that takes over its own creator. There was a, isn't it? That's a common theme in Hollywood. Like, some guy created these super robots, and robots killed him, and he was Blade Runner or something. So, it's a common theme. I mean, it's one of the most common themes in Hollywood. It's like that trilogy that should have been one movie, The Matrix. I mean, it's the same thing in Space Odyssey. It's a whole Hollywood genre that people create machines and the machines take over the people. And the machines enslave the people. it's one of the most popular Hollywood genres. And you could argue that the same thing has happened today. In fact, whenever I hear these exotic conspiracy theories that there's actually a small group of seven people in Kazakhstan that are ruling the world or something, actually the real fact of the matter is that the world's out of control. And so machines don't actually have consciousness, but the truth of this is that the world is out of control. We have created a monster, this whole global economy and global political situation that's out of control. But Krishna, so the Bhagavatam emphasizes that Krishna never does that. It is possible for you yourself to create a situation beyond your control. As if, say, someone jumps off a high place, that was your free choice. But once jumping, the laws of nature, the laws of gravity take over and overcome you, and you have no more control over the situation. Krishna never does that. Maya can never overcome Krishna. It is not the case that Krishna has created a power that can then overcome Krishna. And the Bhagavatam emphasizes this. And that actually is extremely important in understanding Krishna's appearance in this world. You see that I didn't forget that it was Janmashtami. At least not for long. The idea is that when Krishna freely chooses to come to this world, many people misunderstand it. Many people in Vedic culture misunderstand it. Many wannabe Shastra writers misunderstand it. You'll find a lot of Sanskrit literature, a lot of quote-unquote Vedic philosophy in the impersonal line. A lot of the sort of, you know, pop Hinduism. Like, you know, people that off the top of their heads think, I've had that experience, for example, lecturing in Hindu temples, and constantly get people say, well, wait a second, in the Bhagavad Gita it says whatever, and it's not in the Gita. So there's all kinds of misapprehensions, all kinds of imaginations about what's actually in the Gita or in the Vedic literature. So this has probably been the single greatest misunderstanding within Vedic culture, the misunderstanding of the nature of Krishna's appearance in this world. What's actually happening when Krishna takes birth in this world? And therefore, the main philosophical problem in the world, Mayavad, is based on misunderstanding what happened on this day. What happened on this stage in Janmashtami. So, what did happen? Krishna. Oh my God, that's the first time she said that? So, or he, sorry. Small male child. I didn't mean to change the gender if it was a male child. So, the Bhagavatam itself recognizes this paradox. Paradox means an apparent contradiction, something which is not really impossible, but it seems like a contradiction. That's a paradox. So the Bhagavatam itself addresses this problem of trying to understand, as the Bhagavatam puts it, ajo jato, express that the unborn is born. The unborn is born. And in fact, the Bhagavatam talks about this a lot. What really happened when Krishna took birth? Because, I mean, consider from Krishna's point of view. Imagine from Krishna's point of view. Look at that, Bruce Almighty. Anyway, imagine from Krishna's point of view, Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, decides to come to this world. He doesn't have to. Because if Krishna simply wanted to reform souls, he could do it other ways. Krishna could just set up a mechanism that gradually teaches people the truth. Krishna comes freely. As Prabhupada puts it, Prabhupada often writes in his purports that Krishna comes to this world to please his devotees. Because if it was just a question of punishing the non-devotees or correcting them or whatever, the universe already is doing that. In fact, Krishna says in the Gita that the universe is already doing that. He says, Maya Dikshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharaja. By my literally supervision, you know languages, the Latin, English is a combination of old Latin and old German. So the literal Latin for atyaksha is supervision, and the Germanic form is oversight. You know, German Übersicht. Anyway, so supervision and oversight, which is exactly what Krishna is saying. Adi, which means over, super, above, sobre, and vision, aksha, sight. So Krishna says, by my oversight, by my supervision, maya adhyakshena prakriti suyate, prakriti is producing all the living entities and the laws of nature, the laws of karma. It's all going on. But Krishna comes because he loves us. To please the devotees, I mean, imagine, for example, those of you who have children, it's funny because in the old days of the Hare Krishna movement, you gave a class of devotees, almost no one was a parent. And but now, almost no one is not a parent. So when you're a parent, and let's say you send your child off to school, some school, college, or whatever, parents, at least parents who love their children, don't merely send money and pay the bills and send money. But also, they sometimes they go to see their children. They actually want to see their children. It's not just like, okay, I'm doing everything efficiently, I've paid the bills. But you actually want to go and see your children. And Krishna, you know, the psychology of God, Krishna is the supreme parent. The reason that we have the possibility of feeling parental love, the reason that anyone in this world can feel the love of a mother or father is because we are part of Krishna, and he feels that. It's just like Prabhupada said, because Krishna is a person, we are a person. Because Krishna is creative, we have creative power. We have the ability, it's built into us, that we can feel parental love because we're part of Krishna. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Pitaham Asya Jagato, I'm the father of this world, Mata, I'm the mother. It's not just like in the old church service, Patri et Filio, father and son. The old Latin service. Krishna says, I am the father of this world and the mother. Krishna is the mother. So the feelings of a mother originally come from God. And Krishna wants to come and see the kids. It's like imagine if your kids are, they're in college, of course, you can always send them a plane ticket. But if they're in prison, you can't send them a plane ticket. So those of you out there who do not have children in prison, be thankful. Not yet. So anyway, just kidding. So if your kids are in prison, you can't just wire them a ticket, right? You've got to go and see them. So Krishna, of course Krishna could, anyway, we're in this prison of the material world, so Krishna comes to see us. And actually, although Krishna comes to please his devotees, he actually loves everyone, because everyone is really a devotee of Krishna. So Krishna comes out of this, we say causeless mercy. The term causeless mercy is actually an emphatic term, because mercy means causeless. If you look up the word mercy in a dictionary, it means that you're kind to someone who doesn't deserve it. Because if you give someone what they deserve, it's justice. Justice and mercy are different notions. In fact, often there's a tension between justice and mercy. We can see the tension between justice and mercy in the Bhagavatam, for example, the story of Ashwatthama. When Krishna and Arjuna brought Ashwatthama back, Bhima, of course, wanted to kill him, which is not a great surprise. But Draupadi said, Uchitam, Uchitamesha, let him go, let him go. So these are both pure devotees. You often hear questions from devotees like, what is our position on cloning? What is our position on organ donations? What is our position on this? What is our position on that? Fact is that on moral issues that take place within this world, there was often tension and conflict even between pure devotees. There is no one. The Vedic position is that people actually have brains and thought about things, and sometimes came to different conclusions. That's the Vedic position. So I mean, that was a moral issue, to kill Ashwatthama or to let him go, and two pure devotees, Draupadi and Bhima, disagreed. And Krishna compromised. The same thing happened. You see the same tension between justice and mercy at Rukmini's wedding, when Krishna came in and literally unceremoniously took away Rukmini, crashed the wedding party, and took away Rukmini, and then Rukmini, who definitely had emotional problems. Which is the way you say it nowadays. Nowadays, all moral problems are reduced to psychological problems. So Rukmini, who had emotional challenges, he went running after Krishna. And of course, Krishna was simply going to take a little off the top. Krishna was going to kill him. But then Rukmini, imagine, she's just, you know, that's she's married Krishna, and Krishna's wedding present is her brother's head on the floor of the chariot. So Rukmini begged for mercy, and then Krishna compromised. Because Rukmini was so outrageous, so out of control, he had Krishna want to do something, so he just gave him the original punk haircut. You know, cut his beard up, give him a few stripes on top. Then Balaram, of course, Balaram's very funny. Balaram came and told Krishna, like, you shouldn't have done that. You know, this is your brother-in-law. But then when Rukmini offended Balaram, he just killed him. But there's this tension between justice and mercy. And therefore mercy is causeless in the sense that to be merciful to someone means they don't, it's not strictly speaking that they deserve it, you're actually being kind. So Krishna, out of his mercy, which we could say causeless mercy to be emphatic, Krishna comes to this world, and he comes in a human-like form. Now, Krishna is here right now. Krishna's in our heart in a spiritual form, and no one can see him, because we are conditioned souls. So if Krishna just did business as usual, and came in a spiritual form, and that was the end of it, no one would see him. There'd be no point in coming. Like, okay, I've been visible in your heart, now I'm invisible outside of you. So it's... I mean, technically speaking, grammatically speaking, Krishna is not invisible. Because the word visible means something can be seen. For, let's say the city of Tokyo is visible, but you can't see it right now because you don't have the proper conditions to see it. So to be visible means that something is seeable. Krishna is seeable, but he's not seeable to us because of our own problems. If someone has some problem with their eyes so that they can't see, it doesn't mean the world becomes invisible. If I'm blindfolded, the world doesn't become invisible. Rather, my eyes are covered. Prabhupada said that the sun is always in the sky, but we can't see it at certain times. So, Krishna is not invisible, but we can't see him because of our own problems. So when Krishna comes, he makes himself visible. He not only gave Arjuna transcendental eyes to see him in the Bhagavad Gita, see the universal form. It's raining. See, you're trapped in the class. But Krishna, I mean, consider what Krishna does, how kind Krishna is. He gives the whole world eyes to see him. Not to see and understand. If people don't see with understanding, but at least they can see him. And there's all these amazing stories where a demon goes to try to kill Krishna, and suddenly is sort of bewildered or startled at how good-looking Krishna is. Imagine that's not often happen. Imagine, like, if someone's in war, someone's in a battle, and you go to fight someone, suddenly you stop him. God, he's really good-looking. You don't see that often in war movies, or gladiator movies, or anyway, so the idea is Krishna was shockingly good-looking. And even his devotees sometimes, there's this great story in the Mahabharata that when the Pandavas went to perform the Rajasuya sacrifices. So Yudhisthira sort of stayed in the capital and sent his four brothers off in the four directions. And Sahadeva, among the Pandavas, all the Pandavas were handsome, but apparently Sahadeva was really good looking, like a movie star. And so it said he went to the south, and he went to some cities where he was supposed to, you know, do this formal challenge. If anyone here does not accept Yudhisthira, he would go down there, and he was such a, like a movie star. People started like following him, like, oh my God, he's good looking. And at some point, Sahadeva had to say, come on, everybody, this is serious. So what I wanted to say is that is also Krishna's mercy, that even though people can't see Krishna with complete understanding, they don't know he's God, but they can see how beautiful he is. They can see how powerful he is. And if you think about it, if you think about the history of India, Krishna acquired a massive cultural following simply because of how great he is. So even people that could not understand that Krishna is God, or had some doubt about it, or even people, as in Hinduism, there are large numbers of people in Hinduism that don't get it, that don't understand that Krishna's body is spiritual and eternal. As we know, that is an epidemic misunderstanding in Hinduism. And yet, even people that can't understand that Krishna has a spiritual body are attracted to him, because Krishna is the most popular deity in India. Krishna's pastimes as a child, the original shoplifter, you know, the butter thief. And all of Krishna's activities are very attractive. So that even, because to understand that Krishna has a spiritual body, that Krishna comes in a spiritual body, you have to be somewhat detached from your body. If I'm still attached to my body, if I still have my lusty moments and my greed and my vanity, if it's still important to me that people think I'm good looking, of course, you know, you never ask a woman or a sannyasi their age. But if it's still important to me, if it's still important to me to be attractive, well, I mean, obviously it's much too late for me, but if that's still an issue, that doesn't stop people my age. I come from the world capital of cosmetic surgery. I mean, the yellow pages of West LA, Beverly Hills, the section on cosmetic surgery is like, it's not most of the phone book, but it's, there are enough pages that it gets its own color, you know. So even as devotees, we should monitor our own madness. And the extent to which we still have bodily vanity, the extent to which we still have bodily desires, that to that extent, it will be difficult for us to realize, to deeply understand a spiritual body. Because it's like, you know, if our mind is going this way, the mind can't go that way. So it's the old anchor that keeps the boat, you know, stuck in the harbor. So the extent to which we're attached to our bodies, we can't understand Krishna's spiritual body, and yet we can see Krishna's body because, well, there's lots of paintings, and we hear about Krishna coming into body. So when you get a civilization which is basically in the bodily concept of life, for all their piety and all that, still basically stuck in the bodily concept of life, and then this thing happens, that Krishna comes down in the visible body, and acts like a human being, it's not difficult to see where this idea comes from, that some type of impersonal or unembodied deity has taken on a human body. Where does this idea come from? It comes from the bodily concept of life. It comes from illusion. So again, the single biggest and most destructive misunderstanding in the history of Vedic culture, the biggest mistake of all, is the misunderstanding of what happened on this day. So we have to try to... that's why something is at stake. I remember when I was a kid in... well, now you say middle school. We don't say junior high anymore because the word junior could actually affect the self-esteem of a student or teacher engaged in middle school. I mean, there was a time in the world when people were cruel and insensitive and used terms like junior high school. And also we don't say junior college anymore, which is obviously a very insensitive attack on someone's self-esteem. It's now a community college or a two-year institution. So, anyway, back in the dark ages of cruel language, when I was in junior high school, I remember, like, socially, there was this, basically, before puberty, you just sort of like the boys hang out together, the girls hang out together, at least when I was young. But then once you, basically middle school people had gone through puberty, and therefore immediately society became stratified. And sort of there were the more popular people, the moderately popular people, people who were not popular. Everything became all stratified. There were upper. It's interesting how the effect of, that's a whole other class, how the effect of sex desire, when that lust is awakened in the body by puberty, then immediately people start to look down on each other and society becomes stratified into different classes. Anyway, so it's like that. There are different social levels, depending on how much money you have or how attractive you are or, you know, how much political or social influence you have. There are, you know, there are classes. So the spiritual world, you can think of it as the most popular people, in the sense that they're the most beautiful people, but the qualification is not material, it's purity. So if we don't seriously try to become Krishna conscious and get past our material desires, we are condemning ourselves to a very low level. This material world is the whole universe. It's really the boonies. This is for the loser. This is loser loka. This is not where the good parties are. This is not where the fun people are. This is not where the good-looking people hang out. They don't hang out in this universe. So if you really want to get with it, if you want to really have a good time, if you want to be with the people who know what's happening, if you want to, you know, really be good-looking, your material body is, time is not on your side. So if you want to really be happy and have all the wonderful things that life can offer, you have to pay a price. It's like even in the material world, if you want a good job and you want to buy a nice house, you want a nice car, you want to be respected, and if you're not a dropout genius like Bill Gates, then you've got to go to college. You know, there's a theory now that, well, there's a book out now that, well, actually it's overrated and some people are successful without college. But in general, you have to get an education. What does that mean? It means austerity. You have to discipline yourself. You have to do things you don't want to do. You have to show up at places where you'd rather be somewhere else. That's what sadhana bhakti is. Someone that doesn't practice bhakti yoga is basically a dropout. You know, don't be a dropout. It's like in high school, you know, they give you these messages like, don't be a dropout. When I was a kid, they had these really sort of crass little educational movies where Bill, I'm sorry, if anyone here is named Bill, it's not about you necessarily, but, you know, Bill drops out of high school, goes to work at the local gas station, and then gets the money and buys a used car, and while his friends are all in school, he kind of like cruises the high school, honking his horn, and burning rubber, and showing off, and laughing at all those fools that are still in school, and then down the road, all his friends have better jobs and better houses and cars, and Bill's still in the gas station. And the message is, don't be a dropout. So don't be a sodomite dropout. We have to, and by sodomite, I don't mean necessarily that we have to, you know, do a four-hour morning program, which, frankly, I can't do anymore. I mean, I'd have to be hospitalized every day after the morning program. I have to admit to, you know, to be honest about this, that I do a morning program, I do a leaving program, but they are significantly shorter and simpler than you find sometimes at temples. So I'm not discouraging people to go to the temples. The temples, you know, Krishna's here. But somehow or other, everyone according to their own, and of course I will be going to the preaching center, but so I really underrated myself, but you know, to your own, whatever you can do, practice bhakti yoga, because Krishna is at stake. We can get Krishna. And we really have to put in the time. We really have to take it as a very something. The most wonderful thing in the world can be yours if in your own way, according to your own physical and spiritual possibilities, if we just regularly practice Krishna consciousness, we can advance toward Krishna and regain our real life. Krishna came here for our sake. Krishna came for us. Krishna came for you and he came for me. Krishna not only came in general to save the world, he actually came for you. And he came for me. Kunti says this in her prayers, in the first canto. She said people have different theories as to why Krishna came, because there was no Bhagavatam yet, because Krishna was still doing his thing in this world. But Kunti said that some sages said to Krishna that you came so that in the future people could talk about you and glorify you. So Kunti herself spoke about this, what we're doing right here and right now in this room. Kunti Devi spoke about it. She predicted this event that's going on right now. She said, Krishna, you came to this world so that in the future people could talk about the fact that you came to this world. So Krishna came for you, and Krishna came for me. And we can talk about his birth and how he appeared and what he did. That's why he came, for us. So we should, my God, I mean, it's obvious what the right thing to do is. We should take seriously these festivals like today. It's an opportunity to strengthen our higher taste so that we wake up tomorrow morning. It's not, okay, you know, I'm looking forward to next year. I'll go back to the deities again. When we wake up tomorrow morning, we should keep the ball rolling, keep this momentum going. Krishna uses this language in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 4, this beautiful verse. He says, there is a wheel that's been made to turn. That's literally what Krishna says. Evam pravarti tam chakra. Chakra means a wheel, like this. There's been a wheel that has been made to turn. And those who do not keep the wheel turning live in vain. Krishna says, Mogan Bhartasajivati, that person lives in vain. A guy of their whole life is an offense against nature. And this wheel, which also means cycle, wheel or cycle, is that we are receiving, I think chapter 3 actually, or chapter 4. Anyway, I'll stop here. So, it's that we are receiving people who are kind of very much in a beginning stage of thinking, say, attributed to the universe, like the universe is so kind to me, as if, you know, there are, I mean, what is the universe? The universe is trees and tents and hardware stores and asteroids and styrofoam cups again. And, you know, the plumbing in your bathroom. I mean, that's the universe. So what part of it gave you whatever? You know, was it your basement plumbing? What, there are no basements in Florida, of course. So, you know, when you say the universe gave me something, do you mean that if you take all the asteroids and electric saws and living things and put it all together, it becomes someone's body? I mean, what are we talking about? It becomes conscious. So, Prabhupada talked about that in his discussion. I mean, nowadays, people don't do people don't do technical virat meditation. People don't meditate on the universal form nowadays. It's like, oh, there are the hills, those are the stacks of his bones, and so on. Very few people, you may have noticed, actually engage in formal virat meditation. But the Bhagavatam is just giving the idea. Huge numbers of people attribute divine powers and consciousness to the physical universe. And so this tendency, which Prabhupada calls aboriginal. Anyway, so, but Krishna says, so we're receiving so many things. Again, people who are sort of the aboriginal metaphysicians will attribute this to the universe, but actually it's coming from Krishna. So we receive things and we offer them back. We offer them back. When you receive and offer back, that creates a cycle. That is the cycle Krishna's talking about. The pravartitam chakram, the wheel that has been made to turn. And Krishna says, if you don't keep the wheel turning, you live in vain. Now, practicing Krishna consciousness in your own way, in your own time, you know, if you have your 8:30 in the morning Mangal Arati, whatever, but we do the best we can. But that's the wheel, because when are we not taking? Every time you take a breath, you are taking, you're receiving. Every moment that we're alive, every moment that we exist, we are receiving the mercy of God. So you can't stop receiving. You can't stop God from giving you gifts. And any day, any moment that we're not thinking of Krishna, we are taking and not giving back. Because you can't stop taking. You can't stop receiving. And so if we stop giving back, well, you can see the, what all this means. We're not keeping the wheel turning. It's a failure of gratitude. It's a failure of decency not to offer back to Krishna. So it's a serious thing. And again, everyone try your best. It's not that, you know, there's like one size fits everyone for the practice of Krishna consciousness. Everyone in their own way, everyone according to their best ability, we should be constantly giving back to Krishna. That is Krishna consciousness, and keep the wheel turning. That's really what life is about. And Krishna says there's no other way to be happy. Krishna says for one who does not give back, there is no happiness in this life. And no happiness in the next life. He uses the word yajna, sacrifice, but it's about giving back. That's what sacrifice means. It's about receiving and offering back. That is sacrifice. So Krishna came today, and let's take advantage and advance in Krishna consciousness. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Well, since there's no breakfast, are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you very much for the review. My question to you is based on a couple of things today. You were talking before about parents who go to their children in college, or more realistically pertaining to our situation, go to their children in prison. And you're talking about freedom and necessity, and it's just about free. But the parent who goes to their child in prison, or her child in prison, is not going there because they actually have to. They're going there because they feel they have to. And so the question to you is, you're talking about thinking from Krishna's point of view.
Yes.
Does Krishna feel that he has to?
Well, when parents go to see their children, I think parents who go because they'll feel guilty if they don't, I wouldn't call that the highest stage of love. I was very fortunate to have loving parents. They haven't quite made the Vedic curve. But they were certainly loving, affectionate parents. And I think they came to see me often. I mean, sometimes I got myself in trouble again because I had to. But I think at times they would visit me simply because out of love. So I experienced that love. And I'm sure here in this room there are many, many parents who love their children.
I was just remembering, I don't remember where this is, that when Prabhupada talks about how Krishna is purchased by devotees.
Yes.
Is that something that's just a manner of speech, or is that Krishna feels like, oh, this person loves me, this person wants me?
Love is attractive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very, if someone is falling in love with you, even if they're not a serious candidate for your commitment, it is attractive. I mean, definitely people keep score of who falls in love with you, right? I mean, it's not that everyone that falls in love with you, you're going to give yourself to them, but we definitely keep score. And it's flattering, and we, you know, we definitely, it goes into our little internal almanac. Yeah, I remember when I was, I remember so-and-so was just, she was just mad about me, you know. Yeah, it didn't work out, but yeah, I remember that. So, there's something very attractive about someone falling in love with you. And so Krishna has no material desire. It's not that it's feeding Krishna's vanity because we love him. But reciprocating, it's just there's something, it gets into a very subtle point of psychology. Because if you think about it, some things are very gross and crass and disgusting, like someone that just goes and steals from some innocent person and pushes them out of the way and, you know, like takes their food. Or I mean, there are certain types of thievery or rape or exploitation which are just disgusting and gross and crass. And there are certain types of goodness which are obvious. But there are certain kinds of, you get the fine line. I mean, for example, let's say you own some land. And obviously, this is your land, that's your neighbor's land. But when you're right on the border, there can be border disputes. There aren't disputes about the center of your land and the center of your neighbor's land. The disputes are about the border. And if you look at disputes between countries like Alsace-Lorraine, I mean, if you look at the history of Europe, all these border disputes. Because it is the border. So it's at the border of material and spiritual psychology that it can get very tricky. And that's why devotees in the early days of the movement kind of it's just like, you know, young immature sannyasis were always bashing, women or marriage to try to protect themselves. So in the same way, in the early days of the movement, we used to bash the mode of goodness. We were sattva bashers because it was the primitives in the mode of goodness. You know, we don't like always use the K word. So it was the... We allowed to use the K word in the last one. It was the non-devotees, the karmic. It was the non-devotees in the mode of goodness, in a sense, were most threatening to us because they were most like us. So therefore, hardly a Sunday went by when there wasn't a farcical play about the bogey yogi. And, you know, people who were really just totally didn't understand anything about life would be vegan. Or vegetarian, but not Krishna conscious. So the mode of goodness kind of was because it was the closest thing to us. So when you think about it, I mean, that boundary area where someone is very good and very virtuous, but not quite purely spiritual, is it spiritual or is it material? It can be a little ambiguous. And if you think of love, especially, and this is another point, there's a reason why so many people historically, so many philosophers thought that when you become pure, you don't have desires. Precisely because of this nebulous, this tricky border area of psychology. Where I have desires, I have will, I want things, I react strongly, I have emotions, and yet it's not material, it's not selfish. I'm pursuing something, but it's not selfish. It's such a tricky area that one of the great philosophical debates in the West is, can there be real altruism? Altruism means that I do something truly for the benefit of another. And there are many philosophers that concluded that no, whenever you choose to do something, you must have some self-interest. You must be trying to satisfy yourself to some extent, however noble. And therefore, the philosophical debate, can there be true and pure altruism where you entirely do something for the benefit of someone else? In a sense, that's the Western philosophical version of the Indian debate over personalism and impersonalism. Can you have a pure soul that has desires? So as we advance in Krishna consciousness, which means to advance in love, and then we get over this doubt about Krishna, because there was a lot of doubt about Krishna. I mean, this doubt about Krishna, it's found everywhere in the Bhagavatam, and it's addressed everywhere. For example, one form of this doubt is that Krishna took the side of the demigods. How can a pure soul get involved politically? Because political things means friends and enemies. How can a person say, these are my friends, these are my enemies, I'm engaged in a war? Wars are very passionate, gritty things. So I'm in this war, I'm fighting against these people as if they're my enemies. How can this be a pure soul? And the question comes up again and again and again. Yudhisthira raises this question. And other great souls, how could Krishna engage politically militarily, fighting against some people if they're all his own children. I mean, parents don't go and engage in war usually against their own children. I mean, there are exceptional cases like civil wars and things, but... So these questions arose about the personality of Krishna. How could he have a body? How could his body be visible in a physical world? How could Krishna get involved politically? How could Krishna, have his affairs with the gopis? How could Krishna get married? How could Krishna do all these things, which demonstrate desire, will, preference? How could Krishna do all these things and still be a pure soul without any false ego or material desire? This is the big issue in Vedic culture. And the Bhagavatam addresses this constantly. Bhagavatam constantly addresses this issue. So when we look at ourselves and say, how can I be a pure soul and really love and yet still give special attention to my family and still, care about some people more than others, or still prefer the company of some people over others, or still care about what's going on in this world? Anyway, this is all the ultimate psychology, figuring these things out, and experiencing pure love beyond selfish desire. So, perhaps we'll end here for now. Thank you all very much. Happy Janmashtami.